Jesus closes his Sermon on the Mount with a parable. A wise man builds his house on the rock, a foolish man on the sand. On the surface, there's not much difference between the two houses. They may have shared the same blueprints, perhaps even the same siding and trim. It wasn't until the storm hit that a difference in the houses became apparent. The house on the sand collapsed, and as Jesus said, great was its fall. While the house on the rock never budged, it endured. And Jesus explains his parable. Whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. The foolish man who built on the sand is everyone who hears his sayings and does not do them. But it was the foundation of the house that decided its future. Jesus' parable was addressed to his disciples, but it could have described the first two kings of Israel. David feared and obeyed the Lord. He refused to harm Saul, God's anointed, even when it was within his power to do so. While Saul had no fear of God, he acted on impulse, not conviction. Saul usually did what was best for Saul. And as a result, when the storms came, Saul folded like a cardboard box in a thunderstorm. Today we're going to look at the tragic fall of a once tall Saul. And the words of Jesus are again appropriate. Great was his fall. 1 Samuel 27 begins, "And David said in his heart, 'Now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul.'" Wait a minute, David. Remember, he had just said with his mouth, Chapter 26, verse 24, "As your life was valued much this day in my eyes," he said to Saul after sparing him, "so let my life be valued much in the eyes of the Lord, and let him deliver me out of all tribulation." Boy, what he had said with his mouth, he's now denying in his heart. David had made the right confession, but now he struggles to back it up with faith. Has that ever been you? Twice now, David has had Saul in his sights, and yet he's refused to pull the trigger. Of the 600 men in David's posse, 599 had assumed that God had delivered Saul into David's hands so that he could kill him. Only one, David, figured that God had turned Saul over to him to see if he would bless him. This was a huge test. Would David fear the Lord and honor God's anointed? Would he trust in God's timing or take matters into his own hands? David passed the test. But nothing in his circumstances immediately changes. This is different than what we thought. Do the right thing and aren't you supposed to be instantly rewarded? Don't stories of obedience all end with a happy ending? Put God first and don't you win the game? In his book, A Tale of Three Kings, Gene Edwards, he writes this of this particular time in David's life. "These were David's darkest hours. You know them as his pre-king days, but he didn't. He assumed this was his lot forever. And as a result, David sunk into a deep, dark depression. In fact, David became desperate. He says, 'There is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines. And Saul will despair of me to seek me any more in any part of Israel. So I shall escape out of his hand.'" David gets so depressed, he thinks he'll be safer with the enemy than with God's people. Saul won't dare chase him into Philistine country. It seems to David to be his only option. And so David arose and went over with the 600 men who were with him to Achish, the son of Maok, king of Gath. And so David dwelt with Achish at Gath, he and his men, each man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow. Now you recall 1 Samuel 21, This is David's second try at hiding out in the city of Gath. And this is still a mystery to me. Why David keeps choosing this city of all places. Remember, this was Goliath's hometown. This was where the giant lived. David knew that he would face personal and family vendettas in the city of Gath. And it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he sought him no more. At least it ended Saul's quest. Then David said to Achish. Now you recall on his first visit to Gath, David got scared. He got cold feet, and so he pretended to be mad. He acted like a crazy man, started bouncing off the walls. Achish had all the crazy people he could handle. And so he sent David away. This time, though, David asked to coexist. He says, "If I have now found favor in your eyes, let them give me a place in some town in the country that I may dwell there. For why should your servant dwell in the royal city with you?" In essence, you may not have a city big enough for the both of us. And so Achish gave him Ziklag that day. Ziklag was a suburb of Gath. Therefore, Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this very day. Now, the time that David dwelt in the country of the Philistines was 1 full year and 4 months. And David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites, the Girzites, and the Amalekites, all Israel's ancient enemies. Verse 9, whenever David attacked the land, he left neither man nor woman alive, but took away the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, the camels, and the apparel. And he returned and came to Achish. David's men were warriors, and warriors need to war. And so David attacked these pro-Philistine nations, enemies of Israel, and eliminated the eyewitnesses. He doesn't want it to get back to Achish that he's been fighting people friendly to the Philistines. Well, then Achish would say, "Where have you made a raid today?" And David would say, "Against the southern area of Judah, or against the southern area of the Jerahmeelites, a family in Judah, or against the southern area of the Kenites, who were Jewish allies." And apparently this was a common thing. David had the king of Gath believing that he had changed teams, that he was now a Philistine ally who was going out picking off Israeli towns. He was probably splitting the spoils with Achish. The king didn't care. He wouldn't ask any questions. He was getting rich. To Achish, David had become a desert pirate. Arr. Hey, note this. David is no longer in Israel, but Israel is still in David. For he's still fighting against the Philistines on behalf of Israel. In Ziklag, David went undercover. He had made friends with the Philistines to survive, all the while fighting for God and for Israel. And in a sense, this is what the Christian does in the world today. This is our role. We too live behind enemy lines. We're undercover for Christ. And we should try to live peaceably for our own survival, but shrewdly, we should fight and win battles for Jesus to further his future kingdom. One day he's going to return. He's going to be king. Chapter 28 tells us, "Now it happened in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for war to fight with Israel. And Achish said to David, 'You assuredly know that you will go out with me to battle, you and your men.' And David said to Achish, 'Surely you know what your servant can do.'" David's just playing along now. "And Achish said to David, 'Therefore I will make you one of my chief guardians forever.'" Seems that David has thoroughly convinced Achish that he is now truly his ally. Meanwhile, back in Israel's court, King Saul reaches new heights of madness. Verse 3 tells us, "For now Samuel had died, and all Israel had lamented for him and buried him in Ramah, in his own city. Remember, Samuel had been God's prophet to the nation. For decades, whenever God wanted to deliver a message, he had sent Samuel. But now Saul is about to need divine guidance, and Samuel is no longer here. Verse 3 tells us, and Saul had put the mediums and the spiritists out of the land. This had been a noble act in Saul's earlier years. Saul had started out sincerely wanting to serve God. He just wanted to serve himself more. But in a stand for righteousness, Saul had excommunicated the witches and the channelers and the palm readers and the fortune tellers and the astrologers, everyone who had dabbled in the occult. Be careful of any method that promises supernatural power or guidance while sidestepping God. We're forbidden to exclude God in any of our plans or predictions for the future. But again, a trait indicative of Saul, the king fails to obey God fully. Leviticus 20, verse 27 had commanded, a man or a woman who is a medium or who has similar spirits shall surely be put to death. They shall stone them with stones. Their blood shall be upon them. You see, if Saul had fully obeyed God's law and eliminated the occultists, this sad chapter would have never been written. But again, Saul falls prey to the trap of partial obedience. It's always dangerous. Verse 4. Then the Philistines gathered together and came and camped at Shunem. They had invaded the Jezreel Valley in northern Israel and camped at this little city of Shunem. So Saul gathered all Israel together and they encamped at Gilboa. Shunem was right below the base of Mount Gilboa. The two armies now are squaring off. Now when Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. And when Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams, or by Urim, or by the prophets. Remember, Saul's downfall had begun 30 years earlier when he failed to obey the Lord at Gilgal. He had refused to execute judgment on Amalek. And right after that fact, we're told, the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. Now Saul is in desperate need of divine guidance, and so he prays. But the heavens are brass, like his prayers are bouncing off the ceiling. The prophet Samuel is no longer around to bail him out. God isn't trying to be cruel by not answering Saul's prayers. But why do we expect God to continue to speak to us when we don't obey what he's already told us? This was Saul's problem. Saul had already shown that he wouldn't obey the Lord. And so why is he praying now? Why is he asking again for God's guidance? He hasn't followed it to this point. Saul can pray all he wants, but God refuses to play. And here the king of Israel sinks to his lowest depths. For then Saul said to his servants, find me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her. And his servant said to him, in fact, there is a woman who is a medium at Endor. Now Endor was a village near Mount Gilboa in the Jezreel Valley, but it was in Philistine territory. There's actually a tradition that this witch was the mother of Abner, Saul's general. So they didn't have to search very far for a medium. Another reason that Saul met the witch of Endor, he knew that he was committing an abomination, and he was too ashamed to do it outside, and so he met her indoor. I thought you'd need a little help on that one, so he met her indoor. Get it? Indoor? Yeah. So Saul disguised himself and he put on other clothes and he went, and two men with him, and they came to the woman by night. Now the king is so ashamed of his abomination of going to this witch that he shows up incognito. He's disguised. Early after Saul rebelled at Gilgal, Samuel had warned him, rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. I mean, when Saul first heard that, he was offended. At the time, Saul would never think of consulting a witch. And in his mind, how could partial obedience, how could a little rebellion be the same as the evil of witchcraft? Yet now, 10 years later, because of his underlying rebellion, guess where he's turned? He has eventually turned to witchcraft. Be careful. Persistent compromises ultimately lead to abominable acts. There is a little-known Jewish tradition that says that when Saul walked up to the witch of Endor, she had this silly grin on her face. So Saul said to her, "Lady, wipe that smile off your face right now." She refused, and so Saul slapped the woman. Later, he was arrested and charged with striking a happy medium. Where's that laugh track? In reality, Saul asked the woman, "Please conduct a seance for me and bring up for me the one I shall name to you." Saul wants to talk to a dead person, a practice that was specifically forbidden by God's law. Well, then the woman said to him, "Look, you know what Saul has done, how he has cut off the mediums and the spiritists from the land. Why then do you lay a snare for my life to cause me to die?" The witch knew of Saul's former opposition. She has no idea that he's now her customer. And Saul swore to her by the Lord, saying, "As the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing." Then the woman said, "Whom shall I bring up for you?" And he said, "Bring up Samuel for me." And what happens next is a shock. It's a surprise to her and to everyone involved. The witch doesn't even have time to speak her incantation or to muster up her spell, when suddenly she's shocked by what she sees. For when the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice. She screamed. And the woman spoke to Saul, saying, "Why have you deceived me? For you are Saul." She thinks this is all a sting. She's about to get busted. This is all just a setup. But notice here, when the witch saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice. To see a real person frightened her. Commentator Philip Keller, he writes of this incident, "In terror she screamed. This was not the usual weird apparition that came to her otherwise beclouded mind and deluded spirit. No, this was an act of the living Lord. This was the one time that such a thing actually happened." I believe that this medium was shocked by the reality of the phenomena. Normally, a seance is either a farce or a demon impersonates the person. But on this occasion, it must have actually happened. It was the rare exception. God allowed Saul a brief communication with Samuel. You know, the only other time that a man actually gets brought back from the dead is at the Mount of Transfiguration. You remember there Moses appeared and spoke to Jesus in his glory. Apparently, the spirit world obeys God's boundaries, like it or not. You remember in Luke 16, there we also are told of the travel rules for the dead. You remember when the rich man in hell wants to return and warn his lost brothers of the horrors that are awaiting them. God forbids him to return. He can't come back. He can't cross over the chasm. For once you've been assigned to heaven or hell, there are no hall passes. There are no furloughs. That's why I believe what happens here in 1 Samuel 28 is an exception to the normal rules of death. Well, in verse 13, the witch tells Saul, "I saw a spirit ascending out of the earth." And he asks, "What is his form?" And she said, "An old man is coming up, and he's covered with a mantle." And Saul perceived that it was Samuel. And he stooped with his face to the ground and bowed down. And now Samuel said to Saul, why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? Hey, bud, I was happy where I was. I was before the throne of God enjoying a big party. We were praising the Lord. And you've brought me back to this place. I thought I was gone for good. And Saul answered, I am deeply distressed, for the Philistines make war against me. And God has departed from me and does not answer me anymore, neither by prophets nor by dreams. Therefore I have called you that you may reveal to me what I should do. Well, then Samuel said, why then do you ask me, seeing the Lord has departed from you and has become your enemy? And the Lord has done for himself as he spoke by me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David, because you did not obey the voice of the Lord nor execute his wrath upon Amalek. Therefore the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with you into the hand of the Philistines. And tomorrow, you and your sons will be with me. Not in paradise per se, but in the afterlife. In short, he's saying, Saul, tomorrow you're going to die. There is golf in heaven, and you got a tea time at 9 a.m. Then immediately, Saul fell full length on the ground and was dreadfully afraid because of the words of Samuel. And what follows here is that the witch of Endor, she notices that Saul is weak. He's famished. And so she offers him some food. And at first he refuses. But she kills a fatted calf and she bakes fresh bread. Eventually Saul sits down and he eats what turns out to be his final meal on earth. He's going to be judged the very next day. The king's last meal is a fatted calf after being judged by Samuel at a witch's table. It was a barbecue sandwich. Indeed it was. Chapter 29, moving right along. Then the Philistines gathered together all their armies at Aphek. And the Israelites camped by a fountain, which is in Jezreel. I mean, they're facing off now. And the lords of the Philistines passed in review by hundreds and by thousands. But David and his men passed in review at the rear with Achish. Now, the Philistine city-states had sent their combined armies as a show of force. And apparently, they had a military parade. They march out in front of a giant grandstand packed with people. Imagine now the banners flapping in the breeze, war horses are snorting, combat sandals have been polished, uniforms have been pressed, and there at the end of the line is Achish. But wait, for after Achish is a strange-looking battalion pulling up the rear. And then the princes of the Philistines said, what are these Hebrews doing here? Even the heathen Philistines knew that David was out of place. David wasn't a Philistine. It was odd to see David on the Philistine side of the ball. I wonder how many Christians have been asked this very same question. Coming out of the bar one night, at a raunchy movie that you shouldn't have been at, maybe at a party that gets out of hand, maybe in a liquor store. Has anyone ever approached you and said, oh, you're a Christian. What are you doing here? David was where he didn't belong. And the Philistines knew it. And Achish said to the princes of the Philistines, he comes to David's defense. He tells them that David has been loyal to him for years. But the other Philistine princes are not as trusting and probably smarter than Achish. They see David as a liability, a potential traitor who could turn on them in order to court the favor with Saul. And so they even recall the song that his countrymen used to sing of how David had slain his 10,000s. They remember that those 10,000s were Philistines. Maybe this is why David went to the city of Gath in the first place. He knew that Achish was more gullible than the other Philistine princes. And in verse 6, Achish, he has to apologize to David and send him home. For the lords of the Philistines have spoken. David is not to fight. David complains in verse 8, "But what have I done to this day? What have you found in your servant as long as I have been with you, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king?" I'm certain that David had planned to sabotage the Philistine effort. And so here he feigns disappointment at being denied the opportunity. And yet, despite David's pleas, the next morning he heads home to Ziklag, while Achish and the Philistines march north into battle to the Valley of Jezreel. By the way, the Valley of Jezreel is also known as the Valley of Armageddon. It's a very famous battlefield. It's the site of some of history's most important battles. It's also where the future final battle between Christ and the Antichrist will one day be fought. Well, chapter 30. Now it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag, attacked Ziklag and burned it with fire, and had taken captive the women and those who were there, from small to great. They did not kill anyone, but carried them away and went their way. So while David is off being rejected by the Philistines, the Amalekites took revenge on David's looting. They retaliated against David with an attack of their own. They burn down the city of Ziklag and all its homes, and they take the Hebrew wives and children captive. Verse 4, and you really have to feel for David. Then David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. You ever cried till you couldn't cry anymore? This is how David felt. He grieved deeply. His family is gone. And David's two wives, Ahinoam and Abigail, had been taken captive. And now David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and his daughters. Now David is mourning the loss of his own family, which would have been heartbreak enough. But a mutiny breaks out. Angry men blame David for the actions of the Amalekites, and they want to kill David. Can you imagine a more depressing, downtrodden, heart-rending situation? I mean, David here reaches a new low. As the old saying goes, he's lower than a snake's belly. That's pretty low. You know, in high school I played quarterback, and there's a quote about quarterbacks. When a team wins, the quarterback gets too much of the credit. And when it loses, he takes too much of the blame. This is also true of a pastor. Once upon a time, an old pastor, he turned the church over to a younger man. And along with the keys to the church, he handed this young pastor three envelopes. Each was numbered 1, 2, and 3. The old guy, he told the new pastor, he said, "When the honeymoon's over and the criticism becomes vocal, I want you to open these envelopes in order, 1 and 2 and 3. Well, it didn't take long for the young man to feel the heat of criticism. And so he opened the first envelope. It said, "Blame everything on the former pastor." Well, he followed the advice and it worked pretty well, at least for a while. But soon the opposition found another reason to attack. And so the pastor opened the second envelope. It read, "Blame everything on the denomination." Again, he followed the advice, and it staved off the vultures. It was great. Well, finally, the criticism and the attacks, man, they grew more frequent, more vicious. And so this time he opened the third envelope, and it read, "Start preparing 3 envelopes. Here, David feels like it's time to prepare 3 envelopes. But I love how he overcomes. I love how he overcomes here. We're told David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. He strengthened himself. Did you know you could do that? On previous occasions when David was downtrodden, God sent people to encourage him. Remember the prophet Gad? His pal Jonathan came to him in the woods to encourage his heart. He was encouraged by the woman Abigail. But no one here comes to encourage David at Ziklag. And there are times when God cuts us off from the support of friends and family. We have no one. This forces us to depend wholly and solely on God. And it's through the discipline of loneliness that God teaches us that He alone is faithful to meet all our needs. This is why we need to read the Bible for ourselves and develop our own personal prayer life and to practice God's presence daily in our own lives and to personalize God's promises so that when the day comes when you're abandoned and all alone, you too can strengthen yourself in the Lord. Verse 7, then David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, please bring the ephod here to me. And Abiathar brought the ephod to David. Now again, this is really strange to us because we have no parallels to the priestly attire and what the priest wore. The ephod was the sacred smock to which the breastplate was attached. The breastplate was a piece of cloth that had 12 jewels displayed on the breastplate. It was folded in such a way so that the breastplate created a pouch. Two more stones were placed inside the pouch, the Urim and the Thummim, which were somehow, we don't know how, were used by the priest to seek God's guidance. Now imagine needing to know God's will and reaching your hand into this supernatural pouch and presto, you got it. No seeking, no praying, no walking in the Spirit, just instant answers. But the problem is that that pouch was only available to the priest. That's why David kept sending for Abiathar. But for anyone not the king, this created quite the dilemma. The Hebrews loved God and they wanted to serve God. But they lacked the persistent indwelling presence of His Spirit that has now been given to all new covenant believers. David knew enough of God to strengthen himself, but he felt enough separation from God that he tried to make up for it through mechanical means, this ephod. And thus he was constantly calling for the priest for guidance. You know, the old covenant, according to the book of Hebrews, the old covenant produced an inferior, incomplete relationship with God, and this is why. Because they lacked a personal indwelling presence of the Holy Spirit. But to new covenant believers like you and me, we've been given a far better covenant because God's Spirit has been sent to dwell in our hearts and lead us and guide us as we walk with Him. And so David inquired of the Lord, again, using this ephod, saying, shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them? And he answered him, pursue, for you shall surely overtake them and without fail recover all. So David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Bezor, where those stayed who were left behind. So David's troops are moving south from Ziklag in hot pursuit of the Amalekites, who lived down in the deserts of the Sinai. And David comes to this brook. He realizes that some of his men are slowing him down. They've gotten tired. Oh, desert warfare called for a lean, mean fighting machine. You can't have people slowing you down. And so at the brook, he splits his men into two groups. 400 men remain with David and pursue the Amalekites, while the other 200 men stay with the supplies there by the brook. Now, just sort of speed up the story. In verse 11, the Israelites find a dying man. He's had nothing to eat or drink for 3 days. He's a possible informant, and so David's men nurture him back to health. Verse 13, then David said to him, to whom do you belong and where are you from? And the man tells David that he's an Egyptian servant of an Amalekite who had participated in the raid at Ziklag. David asks him if he knows the whereabouts of the Amalekites. He said yes, he'll take David to them if he promises him protection. Verse 16. And when he had brought him down, there they were. And imagine David crawling up the mountainside, looking over the rim of the valley to the valley below. And what does he see spread out over all the land? Eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil which they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. They're having a party with David's stuff. These arrogant Amalekites are enjoying the spoils of a burned down Ziklag. And here's David's battle strategy. He says, let's attack them while they're hungover. Good strategy indeed. He waits until twilight. And not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. So David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away. And David rescued his two wives. And nothing of theirs was lacking, either small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything which they had taken from them. David recovered all and said, this is David's spoil. But what about those 200 weary men that they left behind at the brook? Those who had fought with David, they resented their lack of participation in the battle. They said, give them back their wives and let's get rid of them. They're no good to us. But David disagrees. God gave them the victory and they need to share it with everyone. And David says in verse 24, as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies. They shall share alike. Recall the original purpose for this regional cause for this whole episode. You remember when David went out to the Philistines with Achish? No one had stayed behind to protect Ziklag. And David had learned the hard way that those who protect the supplies are just as important as those who lead the charge. And so it was from that day forward that David made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day. David established a principle that the folks who step out and obtain and those who stay back and maintain are equally important. A principle that still applies today in the church. Some of us are called to fight on the front lines. We teach and we lead and we interact publicly. Other members of the body have supportive roles. They run the soundboard or they move tables and chairs or they cook barbecue. In essence, they guard the stuff. But both types of work are vital and important and deserve a similar cut of the spiritual spoils. Verse 26, now when David had returned to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord, and the beneficiaries of his generosity are listed for us. You can read them. Now these are all cities in southern Judah who knew of David's defection to the Philistines. That's why this was a diplomatic move. David does this to let his fellow Jews know that he's still loyal to them and to Israel, and one day he's going to be their king. Chapter 31 recounts the Battle of Gilboa and the fall of King Saul. There is a verse, Hosea 13, verse 11, where God sums up the reign of King Saul. He says to Israel, I gave you a king in my anger and took him away in my wrath. And in 1 Samuel 31, we're going to see God's wrath at work in his judgment of Saul. Well, now the Philistines fought against Israel. And the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. Saul had allowed his army to turn to shambles. They were poorly prepared for this battle. And they get routed almost instantly. Then the Philistines followed hard after Saul and his sons. And the Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, Saul's sons. Jonathan, David's best friend, fell in battle. Remember, Jonathan had promised David he would serve along his side once he became king. Jonathan died before David could take the throne. The battle became fierce against Saul. The archers hit him, and he was severely wounded by the archers. Ancient armies often had a hit squad of sharpshooters whose sole purpose was to take out the opposition's king. For when the leader fell, it totally demoralized his troops. And Saul has been hit. He's been hit by an arrow. He knows if captured, he's going to be tortured. And so he orders his armor bearer to finish him off. He says, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and thrust me through and abuse me." But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. Tradition says that his armor bearer was Doeg. You remember Doeg? He was the ruthless tattletale who had no problem using his sword to slay the priestly family of Ahimelech back at Nob. But now he refuses to kill Saul. Therefore, Saul took a sword and he fell on it. He fell on his own sword. And when someone deliberately tries to commit suicide, it's a terrible thing. What he or she is saying is that they're more afraid of people's judgment than they are of God's judgment. God doesn't want anyone to resort to that strategy. And so when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. And so Saul, his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men died together that same day. It was a catastrophic loss for the nation of Israel. After this defeat, the Philistines took over a large chunk of the West Bank. Even some of the cities east of the Jordan were evacuated. This becomes the deepest intrusion into Israeli territory ever launched by the Philistines. And so it happened the next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain that they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent word throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim it in the temple of their idols and among the people. They made the defeat of Saul in Israel a national holiday among the Philistines. And then they put Saul's armor in the temple of the Ashtoreth. You know, this too was a common ancient practice. Trophies of war were often displayed in the temples of the conquering nations as a tribute to their gods. You remember earlier when the Ark of the Covenant was taken in battle, what did the Philistines do with it? They put it in the temple of Dagon. Even David followed this practice when he placed Goliath's sword next to the ephod in the tabernacle at Nob. You know, later, God refuses to allow David to build the temple since he is, quote, a man of war. What does that mean? Well, perhaps the idea behind that phrase was that God didn't want David filling up his temple with trophies from his military campaigns. And thus he refused to allow David to build the temple. Well, the Philistines also fastened Saul's body to the wall of Bethshan. On our tours to Israel, we always go to Bethshan. Thankfully, his body's no longer there. Be a terrible sight. Really is a great place to go. It was later turned into a Roman city, one of the cities of the Decapolis that Jesus will visit. But the Philistines nailed Saul's wounded, bloated body to this city wall of Bethshan. In other words, they're rubbing salt in the wound. This brought further shame on Israel. Actually, King Saul's headless body is now a metaphor for the nation. Israel is now without a king. Israel has become a headless body. Verse 11. Then the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul. All the valiant men arose and traveled all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan. And they came to Jabesh and burned them there. Then they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. The men of Jabesh couldn't bear this humiliation and shame, so they came at night to take Saul off the wall. Hey, if you ask me, Saul's been off the wall for a long time. This was a fitting end to Saul. The king who protected his image at all costs ends up a public spectacle of shame and disgrace. Notice, too, the residents of Jabesh, they desire to give Saul's body a decent burial. And so they cremate his remains and they bury his bones. Which brings up the question, what does the Bible say about cremation? And the answer, the Bible is silent on the subject. Yet the result of cremation and natural decay are the same. I mean, it takes cremation about 20 minutes to do what nature does in 20 years. So in my opinion, there's nothing wrong with cremation as long as it's not done in a way that denies the resurrection of those ashes. For one day, everybody's body, burned or buried, is going to be resurrected to either redemption or to condemnation.